Hey Sajid, welcome to the show.
Hi, hi, Alfred. How are you?
Doing good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah, so we talked, you know, we had you on the podcast a couple of years back. We talked about angel investing. And I think it's been a while. Venture markets have changed. You know, investing landscape has changed a lot in the last couple of years. And I thought it would be fun, you know, to have you on the podcast. And because you do so many investments, as far as I know, you're probably in the top five angel investors out there in terms of at least volume that I can see. So I thought it would be interesting to, you know, have you on the podcast, talk about how things have changed. So I guess to start the conversation, how do you see the landscape change from, let's say, you know, 2020, 21 or 2020 to what we are seeing right now?
So it has changed quite a bit. You know, it used to be at the, when we talked last time, we were sort of at the cusp of sort of a bull run. And we saw a lot of companies raising at unjustified valuations. So that has come down significantly. I think once the money is out of the system because of interest rate rise, you know, the global challenges, etc. When the money is out of the system, we are seeing a lot of companies going through significant down rounds, to the extent that one company which has gone on from zero to almost 8 or 9 billion valuation in a span of a year or two has been bankrupt, right? They went for liquidation in the past year or so. So we have seen, those are extreme examples, but in general, we have seen a lot of companies doing down round or struggling to raise. The other thing that I've seen a significant shift is, you know, what happens is when a market goes down, some of the very strong companies also suffer. And we have seen companies with very strong fundamentals could not keep the valuations they raised before. So they also did some down round. And there is a very good opportunity in that space. And we are seeing investors jumping in that opportunity and going into late stage deals, which are happening at a discount. So there were two trends, one on the early stage or in a few late stage companies, we are seeing down round. Well, in some of the late stage companies, we are seeing people going big time into secondaries deals.
Yeah, so you're basically saying the secondary deals that happened in 2021 are basically toast, most of them.
Yeah.
Right? Because I remember when Robinhood was going IPO, and I think the valuations were around 60, 80 billion in private, right? Which is, which I think we haven't seen yet. To for Robinhood to touch that valuation in public markets, right? And we'll probably not see for a while. But I think in spite of you know, change in interest rates, we still see very high valuations, right? One I can think of is, you know, Twitter, perhaps SpaceX, perhaps. I keep seeing secondaries. How do you put SpaceX in this slot?
So, going back to your first point on Robinhood, so, you know, similar thing happened on Stripe.
Yeah.
So I recall it went up to 95, then they do a secondaries at 50. Now, you know, so in fact, myself, a lot of people went into this 50 billion and now it's creeping up to 65, 70 billion. So I think we don't know whether it will reach 95, but so, you know, it may, it's again going in the right direction. Regarding your second point, so Elon Musk is sort of you know, out of this whole narrative. So, you know, his SpaceX, of course, you know, keep on, you know, raising. I think last was at, so we did SpaceX three times so far. And the last one, if I recall, was around 145 billion valuations or stuff. And the hypothesis there was the Starlink, which is, there were some discussions going on that Starlink would be taken out of SpaceX and would be floated as a, because, you know, SpaceX is one of those companies which remain private for a long time, and we don't know when it will go public. But the thinking is that Starlink would be taken out, and Starlink would be 1-to-1, you know, split. So, and the thinking is that the Starlink would be listed around 100 billion plus valuations. So even if
So,
you're,
sorry, go ahead.
yeah, so even if you're investing in SpaceX, you may not, you don't know when you'll get liquidity, but Starlink may, come up with a significant liquidity. And of course, I don't know whether you have seen, he's raising a new, another company called X.AI, which is a generative AI. And that is already in discussions of raising at, I understand, at 15 billion. And that's this sort of like a seed stage valuation. And then, of course, the other AIs like OpenAI and Anthropic, those are going through the roof. So the initial thinking I was saying, generative AI is probably the space where, it doesn't apply.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, I think a year back or, when the first interest rate sort of, hike hit in the US, there was this talk of, a lot of dry powder. Like, this was the key term that was being thrown around. Like, there was a lot of dry powder. And just for the audience sake, I think dry powder at that point referred to the uninvested capital that was already committed to venture capital funds of all different types and stages. It seemed like I've recently seen another article or post where they're still talking about this dry powder at being at its peak. How do you see this whole dry powder phenomenon? Is it coming back, like, or is it's never going to come back in a way that, we were investing in 2020, 2021? How do you see the whole dry powder argument or like phenomena?
I think there is some misunderstanding about this whole dry powder, thesis or how is it used. So first of example, and besides doing the angel investment, I now have a fund. I have actually have three funds, and I'm deploying from there. So I have a broad idea on how this whole dry powder thing works. So first of all, the moment you call a capital, your clock starts ticking, right? So the fund performance starts. So if as a general partner, you're not very sure how to deploy the fund, you don't want to call the capital. So that's one, right? So just because there is an LP commitment doesn't mean it would be drawn down. So that's one. Second is, there are especially in case of institutional LPs, where, they have been participating in your funds over, let's say first fund, second fund, third fund. You also don't want to, put that relationship at a strain. So as a general partner, you are very careful. And in some cases, those institutional LPs usually have an option to pull back from the commitment. And it depends on how the total portfolio of that particular LP is working. Because, that LP might have commitment in public market, which didn't do well and everything stuff. And so, the LP might say, okay, look, I committed 50 million or 100 million to your fund, but I'm now going to cut it down to 30 million. So, so when a fund is announced, let's say some X raised $1 billion, doesn't mean that, that $1 billion is going to be deployed, depending on the situation. So this dry powder would broadly depend on these individual fund scenarios. And of course, how the whole thing plays out in the market. So that's one. In terms of whether it will come back to the previous stage, so this has been said many times when the dot-com bubble happened and other happened, and every people keep saying, oh, it's not going to happen again. But the human psyche is that it keeps happening throughout the cycle. So it will completely depend on how the global situation is, how the total market is. So if hypothetically there is a big problem and US starts printing money, and what the one thing that we have said is every time the money gets printed, it breaks the previous records, right? So, when this financial crisis happened, there were bailout of, $50, $100 billion, and people thought, wow. And then this time there were trillion of dollars getting printed. So we don't know what the next quantum would be, but yeah, usually if it gets printed, it gets in a very large amount. So I'd not be surprised that we see another cycle like 2021 happening in future.
But is the dry powder coming back, or how do you see just whether it is coming back to the market, or is it waiting to still be deployed?
It is slowly coming back. So what we are seeing is, the valuation is ticking up. I'm seeing the funds are raising. Late stage valuation is going up. So yeah, especially in a couple of segments like AI and to some extent crypto nowadays, the valuations are creeping up. Yes. It is not at the same quantum like 2021 before, but my guess is if the market starts, looking up, a lot of these dry powders will start getting deployed. So people are just sitting on the sideline and watching.
You brought up crypto, and I think you are one of the people who've been consistently, I think, investing in crypto, like during the boom and bear, during the bull and bear cycle, I would say. What do you see is happening now in crypto? Because I am not a big investor into crypto, and I don't follow the space much. But I'd love to know what your thoughts on what's happening in the crypto space.
So two things, I now have a fund which specifically focus on Web3 infrastructure. So we don't do crypto as such, like tokens and et cetera, but more on the Web3 infrastructure companies that are building large blockchain, companies. So that's one. So first of all, about this whole Web3 space, there is a lot of scam, a lot of misuse, a lot of, misappropriation, breaking the rules, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of noise out there, and it's very important for investors to take those out of the process, go through the proper due diligence before investing. What changed the narrative significantly is when BlackRock and the large funds started launching ETF on Bitcoin. So that clearly changes the narrative that, okay, if trillions of dollars of funds are coming into the space, then clearly there is a big potential there. So that's one. The second thing, that there are three narratives now driving this Web3 space. One is artificial intelligence. So, while we know artificial intelligence is big on, let's say Web2 companies, in case of Web3 companies, the question remains is the data, the large language models that artificial intelligence use, will it be centralized or decentralized? So if it is centralized, the power of AI still remains on, in a few hands. But if it's a decentralized through blockchain and Web3, then then the power of AI gets more distributed. So one big narrative is the intersection of AI and blockchain or decentralization. So that's one. Second big narrative is what we call RWA, real world assets. So the question is, the large mortgages, housings, large scale, other assets, can those be converted into blockchain and distributed? So real world assets is a big narrative that's coming in. And the third one is what called DeepIn, which is essentially more decentralized infrastructure, i.e. storage, et cetera. Can those be decentralized? So these are the three big narratives currently driving Web3, Web3 boom. And we'll see how it turns out. But again, like previous Web3 boom, there is a lot of scams out there, so everyone should be very careful.
I mean, one of the things, my experience with Web3 is, as you rightly pointed out, everything sounds like a scam in the first place, and everything is ridiculously high priced, and the structure itself is weird to invest. I think investing structures have been innovated a lot on Web3 when it's, during the peak of 2021, which was probably the worst part of it, because you didn't know like how to deal with it. For regular investments, you don't know how to deal with it, but there's this new uncertainty of how to deal with this investment in general. Like, has that part changed a bit, and people sort of established what is the right way to invest?
So there are two things happening, one thing, the one you pointed out. So the big challenge is, companies were raising rounds through token issuance, et cetera, where, you don't even know who the founders are. So you don't even know who these people are, but, people are throwing money, millions of dollars, right? And there are still people doing it because of the hype, because of FOMO, et cetera, et cetera. But interestingly, what I'm seeing companies building, for example, let's say Coinbase launched this whole layer, second layer, as it, or, called Base. Base is based on optimism, and Base is, so there's no token, right? So we are seeing companies which are building large blockchain infrastructure and a pure equity model. So there are no tokens issued and et cetera. So yeah, so there are companies which are very careful, and they know that if they issue token, they may get into a, difficult spot in the US and other places given the restrictions. So they are raising a pure equity, like the Web2 companies. So those are happening also. And in fact, in quite a few companies, people keep wondering when they're going to issue tokens, and they're saying they're not because they don't want to get into this legal troubles with tokens, etc.
Yeah, that's good to know because I think tokens are also misincentivizing the public, right? Because an investor might get early tokens which are liquid pretty early and they could sell and you will not know, right? Which is opposite, in regular structures. I know you are pretty active angel investor. I know that you have a Web3 fund, but you've hinted at two other funds. So how many investments types and how many investments are you doing, taking a step back?
Compared to the last time when we discussed, I was mostly doing AngelList, or other syndicates and etc., which is essentially SPV structure. Now, and the total number of investments, through the, I mean, total has obviously 1,000 plus, I don't, probably 12, 1300, 1500, I don't count anymore. But
How many
on
tax
the,
people do you have?
yeah, so everything, automated, etc. But in terms of the so the way the structure that I'm using is the SPV structure is still continuing, and I have partners running it. So I do it, but mostly the other people are doing it because it has created quite a bit of scale. Then there are funds which are essentially, one is obviously the Web3 fund that I mentioned. The other is the YC fund because there's a lot of companies coming into YC. So I have a fund which dedicated to YC focused fund, and that's that we do. And the third one is a general purpose fund. And so, which is essentially companies, early stage companies where we invest. Now, what I'm working on now is artificial intelligence, generative AI focused fund, because, we are seeing not only late stage deals, but quite a few early stage deals that are coming up on AI space. And some of those are very interesting companies. So we are now working on an AI focused fund, which we probably launch soon. So then this would be the four funds.
So, when you think of raising a new fund, are you thinking, because you're based in Jakarta, Bangladesh, but your investments are all over the world. When you are conceptualizing a new fund, who are the LPs that you generally think of?
Mostly US-based LPs. So what we have in the funds are, because a lot of our companies, while I'm based in Jakarta, a lot of the companies are essentially US companies. So I would say 80% plus, maybe 90% companies are US, and the LPs are primarily from US. There are a few from Asia, Europe, LATAM, other places, but yeah, almost 70% plus, almost 80% would be US-based LPs. And these are, yeah, sorry,
Sorry,
sorry.
go ahead.
And these are essentially people from family offices. So people running family offices, investing, or a few, high net worth individuals. And there are a few cases, there are institutions, or companies which have set aside some fund to invest in other funds.
Regarding the YC fund, there are at least a couple of YC funds I've seen. Brian, who was on my last episode, has a YC fund. I think AngelList themselves run a YC fund. There are some YC funds run by, YC alumni. How do you sort of differentiate when you have, so many YC funds and you're pitching a new YC fund, or when you pitch now that it's established? Like, how did you approach that?
So, there are two things I'm seeing happening in the YC space. One is people are investing cohort basis. So all the names you mentioned, they will say, okay, we're raising a fund, or we have this fund which will invest in YC Winter 24 or YC Summer 24 or 23, right? So cohort based. I used to do that before. So I had one fund, YC fund before, which was a cohort based, actually two funds. The current one that I'm doing is a bit of a perpetual fund. So we are investing over four or five cohorts, and the LPs are getting the, benefit of investing through cohorts rather than a one particular cohort. And then, so there is a possibility, it's a bit of indexing on YC companies over a longer period of time, but at the same time, they're getting exposed to three, four cohorts or five cohorts, etc. So that's one differentiation I started compared to other YC funds. The second thing, which is quite important in case of YC, is that because many funds are pitching to the same company, it's mostly on the founder who decides which company to go with or which fund to go with, because they also have they also don't want to raise indefinite amount. In these cases, the founders will usually reach out and ask specific questions, okay, how can you add value, etc. And that's where I think this whole Asia connection helps, because first of all, YC has an internal system where the founders rate the funds, the previous founders. So, you know, so the YC founders can check what is the, you know, review of this particular fund from the previous alumni, et cetera, et cetera. So that helps them to go out and specifically reach. So I see a lot of inbound reach from YC companies. Second, of course, is the values that the fund bring in. So I'm probably one of the few funds which has this whole Asia, you know, lens and et cetera. And many of the YC companies want to, you know, enter this market. And of course, YC also has few companies from Asia, which goes into the YC batch, and they also like to raise funds from us. So I think that sort of uniquely positions us compared to other funds.
What else? I mean, because you sort of have this vantage point of investing across the world, what other ecosystems have like slowed down or, you know, sort of things changed outside the US?
In general, I would say across the world. So even in Asia, I've seen, you know, funds slow down in India, in, you know, markets in Asia, you know, I see the race has slowed down a bit. And you see a lot of the news coming out of India for late stage companies. So, you know, so there is a bit of, again, a readjustment on the valuations, etc. Same with Africa, same with Latin. You know, what I've seen is across these markets, the valuations have gone down, funders struggling to raise. So it's nothing new. The reason probably being that for funds based out of Asia or, you know, Africa or Latin, most of the LPs are US-based. I'm sure there is a good portion of LPs locally, but also a significant money used to come in. And once that slows down, the rest of the world, you know, especially on the startup space, slows down. So that was happening across the world.
So I'm a little curious how you actually operate. Like when you're running four funds, I think you were, you know, being a CEO last time we talked. I don't know if you're still, you know, a CEO of a company. I'm curious, like, what does your day look like when you have four funds? And I know, like, now I think you're a little bit slow down on angelist syndicates, but, you know, you were very aggressive in terms of deals. I think you're probably the highest, you know, deal maker on angelist. I don't know the stats, but qualitatively, I feel like you have to be, you know, top three. How does your operation system look like? Like, and you also have, when I talk to you, you have a certain level of calmness to how you talk also. Like, I don't understand how you operate.
So the good news is, on the bad news, I'm not the CEO of that company anymore. So that opened up some space because, you know, it was getting too many things. But I joined a couple of boards, and one of the board is a company called ICANN, which is Internet Corporation for Names and Numbers, which is sort of a regulatory body, you know, controlling the whole internet governance, regulations, policies.
This is the organization that issues domain names, right?
Yeah. So they're globally, and, you know, because they issue domain names, all the registries, they have contractual obligations to ICANN. And then I can get involved into the contractual obligations, the regulations, the privacy of individual, you know, registrars, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of interaction between regulators and the ICANN, and that takes quite a bit of my time because I run their audit committee and then, you know, also, you know, a couple of other things. So while I'm not a full-time CEO anymore, but this board and a few other boards are taking some of my time. The way I have structured most of these is I have now brought in partners. So, you know, when we talked last time, I was mostly doing it solo, but now the funds have own partners, the syndicate, most of the deals are through the partners and et cetera. And I do come in once in a while, but so because I have distributed my work, because on my own, it was getting difficult to manage. So that's one. So my everyday is, you know, it starts very early in the morning because a lot of calls are on the US side and then it ends very late in the evening. But it flows through. Different things come up with different funds. And the other thing that is outside the fund, I'm now getting quite involved in a couple of businesses. So I don't know whether did I mention it to you. So I was building one of the large wind power project in Bangladesh. So I built the first 60 megawatt wind project in Bangladesh. You know, so that has gone operation. So it was a $110 million project. Now we are adding another, roughly 200 megawatt in different wind projects, so renewable projects. That's one. So we are working on a EV conversion for two-wheelers and three-wheelers. So we are working with Korean Samsung and other companies to create a, converting existing two-wheelers to three-wheelers into electric vehicles and a battery assembly plant, etc. So I got involved in a couple of other businesses, which is also taking some time.
Again, I don't understand how you operate.
These are all, there are like a lot of partners, so people so some because if you have very strong partners working on different projects, that helps a lot.
I mean, what do you think about your own career? Like, are you always a person who has done more than one thing at any given point of time? Because usually most people do one full-time job and then don't do anything else. Like, if I look around my colleagues or my peer group around, most of the people do this one thing. Like, even me doing a podcast or investing outside my full-time job is an exception in my peer group. Like, why do you think you do all these, different things in different directions?
A good portion of my professional career, I was only doing one thing. So I was in a bank, and so that took me all over the world, and I was essentially working bank most of the time. But once I left the bank, the whole plan was to do two, three things because I was finding getting stuck with one vertical to be boring. So at that point, I started this whole investment thing, this whole building this health company where I was the CEO, and then building this renewable project, which were all quite innovative at that point. And then of course, one led to another. I got exposed to too many other options and everything. And I find it interesting two ways. First of all, personally, it's a good learning experience, professionally as well as. So the things that I learned on building a infrastructure project like a power plants, that some of these, a few of these learnings can be transferred to, investment in a startup, which is very early. So very different type of businesses, right? Or, doing this board roles, which is a very different, like a regulatory role where, discussion happens more like you'd see a discussion in a government level, very, each word is in a memo, each word is a question and whether that should be there or not, compared to a startup where your whole hypothesis is to move fast and, build things and think about the impact later, et cetera, right? So very different hats for different jobs. So that helps. On a purely professional level, or the other side of it is, in a way it's hedged against one another. So even when my startup was not doing well because of this whole funding, the infrastructure project was doing very well because all the energy sector, government projects, large scale 18 years contract and et cetera. Or the ICANN, which is very much a regulatory, where you sort of like don't worry, have the cash flow, so to speak, and et cetera, right? So in a way, if one goes down in terms of activity, the other keeps going up. So it is in a way it's hedged against each other because these are very different types of organizations.
You're sort of removing single point of failure for your own career, I guess.
Yeah, that can happen.
Which you might, know in ICANN, that's all it's all about, right? None of the DNS servers have to go down. In your personal portfolio, how do you hedge startups versus, because startups are, we know that you can lose to zero, and I'm sure you've experienced zeros quite often, right? How do you divide personally, like what percentage of your investments, personal investments before starting the fund, like went to startups?
Oh, it's very high. In my case, my personal net worth is I would say 70% would be tied to startups. So most of, I mean, I hardly do public market. So my investments would essentially be these projects, like large scale infrastructure projects now, which is slowly creeping up as, as they're coming into, start revenue generating. Startup is mostly there, but of course startups will again go up depending on how the market performs, and the other ones is like typical real estate and income from board roles, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the small amount, but it's 70% startups, maybe 80%.
And so you said you mentioned, I think Now you're up to what, 1300, 1400 deals, I'm sure. I think last time we talked, you're up to like 40 unicorns or so. What were some of the big exits that you got?
Purely in terms of multiple, there are a few which got 30x, 40x, etc. It's not like I got those proverbial 1000x, nothing yet. That's why there are a few which are theoretically are trading at 250, 300, 350x, but those are all on paper, so we have yet to see any exit on there. But in an average, so in terms of the total portfolio itself, which is my personal, excluding the funds, those are now trading at on paper. If last time I checked, around 8x. So on the total portfolio level, 8x. The IRR is very high, etc. Of course, those are all theoretical. So a few of those get exit, and I get some money. The others are yet to see lights of the day. In fact, if this whole downturn did not happen in last 2 3 years, I probably would have seen much more exits, because few of those I was expecting exits in like a year or two back, but of course those all have been pushed back. So I'm
Because
hoping
of
that
no
once the market,
IPOs.
I'm hoping once the market goes up, people will start exiting.
But there were also a lot of exits, when Tiger Global and when all the hedge funds came into, early stage investing and did Series A, Series B. I remember that resulted in, some of, for especially pre-seed and seed stage investors, a lot of exits. Was that true on your portfolio level or?
So I personally, I got options, but I personally don't exit. So usually, like you're saying, those cases that investors are given the option that do you want to exit at 5x or whatever the number is. If I recall, I took two or three cases like that, but in most cases where I think the company would go much more. In fact, right now I'm debating on one where I got roughly 12x, and I've been asked whether I want to exit or not, and I essentially said, I want to wait. So, where I'm convinced, I usually wait. But there are opportunities like that that comes up once in a while.
So let's talk a little bit about AI, right? Like I think one big thing that we are seeing, that changed in venture or in general tech, I think, is the explosion of people's perception in terms of how important AI is. I think AI has always been important, right? Like if you're an engineer or if you look at who's getting paid the highest in a tech company, it was always clear that, the AI researcher or the data scientist who's working on the cutting edge models got paid the most. But I think now, like, the public attention has been captured and sort of like investor attention, I think, has also sort of been captured. So what are you seeing in terms of, where the value is being captured and how are you generally thinking about it?
So, two things that I'm seeing in the AI space. One is what we call foundational model, which of course, OpenAI or Anthropic, the companies that are building the foundations. And I did a lot of secondary deals or late stage deals, and I invest in OpenAI, Anthropic, Elon Musk, xAI, Databricks, CoreWeave, Cohere, Perplexity, Stability. So a lot of these AI companies, most of which are in a way foundational models and etc. And my belief is that there will not be many, but two or three that will become really large, which obviously is the plan by all these companies. They will capture a lot of value. So that's one. In fact, I don't know whether you've seen OpenAI also has a app store, sort of like where you can get. So they'll start trying to be almost like Apple and create, capture all this upside. So that's one. The second one, of course, is the applications where you don't need 10 coders, you need five coders, you need three coders, you don't need a tax accountant, you don't need a lawyer. So the application level where apps are built on these foundational models. And a lot of YC companies that we're investing are essentially in that space. So, because a lot of the early stage companies are building different use cases of AI, which will obviously aim is to replace one verticals. We don't know what will be the breakthrough in those cases, because each in the vertical has so many competition. We have to see which one really gets momentum. But of course, the winner will capture values. So the early stage AI fund that we are talking about would mostly invest in those application layer, and because it will be a much wider spread, deployment of funds. So that will be the second one. But on the late stage and some of these early stage, some of the companies are foundational. So I would say a significant value would be captured on foundational models. The one challenge is, like any hype, there's a lot of valuations uptake. And we are seeing companies raising probably $1 billion. And within, a year, they're raising at $5 billion or, I mean, I don't know whether you've seen how the Anthropic valuation went up from, almost four or five times over a year. So those are happening in this space. Whether the revenue is there to justify this valuation is something to be seen. I think there's a lot of hype, and like any other hypes, it will again come down very soon, the valuations.
How do you, I mean, we've seen the valuation trap that we had, right, during 2020 and 2021, where the sort of thesis was, valuations will always be high, so you have to invest. But I was always sort of, I didn't agree with that, because if you go with that logic, then your portfolio will eventually be bad or like biased, or you're like, you end up picking, I forgot the term, but you sort of end up picking the ones you shouldn't be picking, right? So all your portfolio is sort of made up of the same thing. How do you think about that now as a fund manager, right? Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to do angel investing because it's you making the decision for yourself, and you can have a different risk profile, or I just want cash return, or I want to be associated with this company. There are multiple factors, right? When you're investing as a fund, how do you think you look at that? Because if all the foundation models are at like these billions of dollars valuation, how does that, for that to really become, give back the fund, it might take the company for being, 200 billion or 300 billion valued, right? So how do you think about now getting into companies with through the fund?
So I don't have a secondary fund. I don't have a fund. So, so the investment that I'm doing at late stage are mostly SPVs. So I don't have a fund because I have been thinking of doing a secondary fund, which will do late stage and stuff. There are quite a bit of regulatory restrictions around that sort of fund and how will it be restructured, everything, which I'm in talks with lawyers, but still not finalized it yet. There is a bit of a, I mean, I did a few from my funds on secondary late stage, but not a big one, but mostly SPVs. And I agree, even at SPV level, a couple of these investments are very difficult. I mean, the question, of course, is one or two winners would give you a big time. So will OpenAI be a $1 trillion company? Most likely, the way they're, if they can really build the momentum. But will, five others will become a $1 trillion company? Unlikely. So we got an opportunity to invest in OpenAI at $15 billion or $20 billion. It ended up, now at $90 billion and et cetera. So, in the span of a year. So you're talking about 4 or 5x in the span of a year, which is quite good for any return. But most of the cases, I think it will go down. So at a fund level, to generate a significant return, and of course, when you're investing late stage from a fund, you have to write very large checks, right? So to generate return will be very difficult unless, you. Some of these funds are essentially built not like a seed stage fund, so the return expectation is also low. While it is quicker, like a typical fund, which is 10 years, these late stage secondary funds essentially target 3 years, 3 to 5 years by the time they expect that to go to IPO and return. And those cases, I think the maximum they're talking about 2.5x, 3x maximum. So the expectation is low because the liquidity is faster and the return is much more secured compared to an early stage. So those funds are structured in a very different way compared to a seed stage fund.
Got it. I mean, you done, I think, a lot of interesting secondary deals. How do you usually source these deals? Are these you are going and outbound reaching out, or because you built, sort of this network over the years, you're getting them inbound?
So both. In many cases, even a few of my LPs, who are an investor in X or Y company, they reach out and to me, look, I invested in, let's say, OpenAI or Anthropic, and I have my valuation is now, oh, will you be doing a secondary? I want to exit. So I'm seeing a lot of those coming in because I have a
Interesting.
very large LP base, right? So, I think it's 6,000 plus or something. And then there are people, who are always, you know, and so one or two of them invest in, somehow invest in some companies, etc. So that's happening. There are a few cases where I do reach out, specifically not solo stage, but when I see a news of a company raising a big round, and I could not get into that company earlier, I usually reach out and ask them, you know, do you want to, you know, sell some of those. The third one is, of course, the founders. In few cases, that I, you know, in one AI company's case, the founder reached out to me and said that, look, the founder himself wants to sell a part of his share, the common share. And a very interesting structure, and use that sell to invest as an investor to get preferred shares. Yeah. So that was an interesting structure. I said, okay, fine, you know, we get some common shares, etc. So this is a, you know, it's a very individualized cases.
Do you have a sort of a system to meet new people?
Not a system as such. It's more like, you know, like, you know, I'm doing this podcast, or, you know, I used to write blogs and etc. And but nowadays it's mostly word of mouth, people reaching out, because I think the network has gone now so big and across the world. So, you know, there's always, you know, every day in my mail, there'll be, I don't know, 15, 20 outreach, you know, someone is referring someone is trying to pitch and all that stuff. So it has now become quite organic. And, you know, the larger the deal flow, the larger structure, it keeps multiplying, right? So now it has
been. When you were like starting the syndicate, or syndicate was, you know, less than 500, at that point, did you like have an approach or system?
At that time, I used to reach out a lot through LinkedIn, through, you know, at that time, I was more active in podcast, you know, I used to do a lot, and then more active in blogs and everything. So I very carefully did all this so that, you know, I can create more visibility. But now, of course, not to that extent.
Got it. I think one last question I wanted to ask is, how do you consume your information, and what types of information, and from where are you consuming your information?
Oh, that's a big challenge, I tell you. I mean, I regularly struggle with it, and I'm tweaking the system to see how I can best, you know, consume. In fact, I don't know. I mean, even on my books and everything, I used to use, I use iPad a lot. That's sort of my go-to, you know, tool. I use laptop in rare cases, but mostly I iPad. Even now I'm using an iPad. And I found the Kindle in iPad is not very good. And now I'm now using Amazon Kindle, and, you know, I find it very good to reading things. So I now, you know, send my magazines to Amazon Kindle to read on it, and stuff like that. But I depend a lot on blogs. That's one where I get a lot of my information. I do follow a couple of, you know, like Financial Times and Economist for, you know, to get an idea. So those are the two things I read regularly. Other than that, I you know, Twitter, I try to, you know, sort of, in a way, synthesize the, you know, information flow and see whether I can follow the right people to get a synthesis of information. Those would be three. But I still struggle. I mean, there is so much information out there. It's so difficult to, and, you know, given my involvement in very different fields, it's very difficult to get, you know, all the right sort of information. So that's one thing which really helps me a lot, because I sort of consume information throughout the day. You know? So I'm either, you know, either listening to something on podcast, which is, you know, giving me information, or reading something, or working on something. So I sort of do it all through all my waking hours, and that helps.
What are the podcasts that you listen to?
Pretty much a lot. So I do, obviously, I do, there's a one called Bloomberg called Oddlot. Okay. So that's a good synthesis. I obviously, on the Web3 space, I do, you know, there's a one by Laura Shin, there's one by Bankless, there is All In, that's one. Then there is this, there is one, obviously, I mean, there are a few, which is Tim Ferriss, I used to listen to a lot, not so much. So there are quite a few, you know, like 8, 9, which I do regularly. But some of those, I'm trying to recall the name, who does this long 2 hours podcast and everything, 2-3 hours. So, you know, so I sometimes skip those, but I try to get to the key points. So.
Got it. I think one question I suddenly got into my mind. You said you're not investing in public markets. One would think, you know, you're in Asia, a lot of Asian markets, people, you know, look as, you know, the future. I can see a reason why you're not investing in Maybe US equities, and I can make, come up with a reason. What's the reason that you don't invest in public markets in general?
First of all, I need to I need to study more on individual companies. And for me, I probably know more about US companies than Asia companies. I know a lot about, Tesla or Apple or Amazon. I have been in that space. I know how they're doing. I get a lot of data information, but I don't know a lot about the Asian companies who are, big companies in India or other places, right? So I need to really do a lot more study, research, and I don't have the bandwidth to do that at this point. The second option, of course, is to give money to someone of these funds and etc. and let them do it on your behalf. That can I did one or two. The performance is not as good. I feel like I can do it better myself. So I sort of stopped.
Got it. Well, Sajid, this was a fun conversation, and hopefully we'll have you again in a couple of years. And all the best for your funds, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Natarajan. As usual, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.